This episode is brought to you by Miro, the online collaborative whiteboard where distributed product teams get work done. Go from idea to execution using pre-built Kanban boards, sticky notes, and retrospectives all on an infinite canvas. Learn more and try Miro for free. Visit Miro.com to get started. That's Miro.com.
Welcome to the Product Podcast, brought to you by Product School, the podcast where you get fresh insight from leaders at top tech companies and startups. Remember, you can learn product management in person at our 15 campuses worldwide or study with us online. Visit productschool.com to learn more about our courses. You can also hang out with the leaders from these podcasts at our hundreds of annual events and catch us at ProductCon, the world's largest PM conference that takes place every year across the United States and in London.
My name is Laura. I work at Twitch. I'm senior director of the commerce products. The commerce products at Twitch. How many people are familiar with Twitch, first of all? Oh, thank God. Okay, so the commerce products at Twitch are the tools that our streamers use to solicit direct support from their audience. So things like subscriptions or cheering or other types of interactions where there's an exchange of finances to help support the streamers make that their full-time job. It's kind of cool. I joined Twitch in October of 2018. Prior to that, I had been at Adobe for 19 years because I'm really old. I started at Adobe in the video product. I was always in the video products. I started at Adobe. They hired me out of a university teaching video editing. And they hired me as a quality engineer. And they called me. I got a call from a recruiter asking if I was interested in a quality engineering job. And I'm like, oh, I'm not an engineer. I can manage my computer stuff, but I'm not an engineer. And they're like, hold on. Let me explain what a quality engineer is. So they talked me through that a quality engineer, especially in this case, used the Adobe tools like a user, let them know if there were problems with them, and then someone fixed them. And I was like, oh, hold on. I get to tell you what you need to fix? Yes, sign me up. So I started on the Premiere team prior to it being Premiere Pro, which is the video editing tool at Adobe. Was a individual contributor quality engineer, became a lead, became a manager of three managers on that team, then became the primary manager on that team, then became the senior manager for all of the video and audio products at Adobe, the quality, and then I became the director of quality, and at that point I was like, okay, I'm kind of done with quality. At that point I started looking at what do I want to be doing. I wanted to get earlier in the product chain. By the time you're in quality, you're usually cleaning up someone else's mess, right? That's exhausting. It's kind of like being the mom who has to go pick up the garbage and put away the laundry. I didn't want to do that. Also, by the time I discovered problems as a quality leader, it was often too late to fix them before they hit the customers. The other thing I discovered was a lot of the team members that I worked with were all video experts. They had all worked professionally in video or audio. They had a lot of passion for that customer. And I realized that was honestly the most fun part of my job, was identifying problems in the workflow and figuring out how we address those problems in the workflow. And I didn't put two and two together right away. I decided I wanted to go into engineering leadership, which is crazy. But I picked up a project that was in need of a leader at that moment and started running Adobe Story, which was Adobe's first real service. It was an online collaborative screenwriting and pre-production management tool. Did you know Adobe did that? No, most people didn't. The product ended up folding after several years. It became incredibly popular in broadcast soap operas in the UK. That's a very narrow market. We had a hard time convincing other people that Adobe was a place for screenwriting or Adobe was a place for pre-production management. A lot of the tools that we had built, while very powerful and very cool, weren't picked up. So, ended up folding that project. About the time I started leading that project, I was, as I said, doing some exploration on what I wanted to do with my life, what I wanted to do with my career, and I decided to go back to graduate school, because that's what a mother of two in the middle of a house remodel with a full-time job that requires a ton of travel should do. So, I went back to University of Washington's master's degree in communications program, and I jokingly call it my master's degree in social media, but it opened my eyes to a whole world of things that were happening outside of broadcast and motion pictures. Now, I had been on social media, I'd been super addicted to every new platform as they came out, and this gave me a reason to study them. And by studying them and spending justified time, I could be goofing around on Facebook and be like, I'm doing my homework, don't bother me. I got to do a lot more experience of something that was different than things I had already known a lot about, which is cool, because anytime you can open your horizons a little bit, you open yourselves up to understanding new people and new customers and new problems. So I came back to Adobe and I said, oh my God, we're missing this entire segment of customers. We really need to start investing in work for YouTubers. And I was told, yeah, go figure out what that looks like. At the same time, having been the head of the Adobe Story product, the head of product management for the video products came to me and said, hey, you actually were doing a really good job product managing. And in fact, a lot of the things you had done when you thought you were a quality director was actually product management, because you were doing identification of problems and needs and documenting the ways they should be solved. I want you to lead the video services for Creative Cloud for video. And I was like, do I have to be a product manager? Because I was a jerk. And he's like, yeah, you'd have to be a product manager.
Okay.
So at that point, I wasn't committed to the name because I didn't really understand exactly what the role was. But I decided I have all this new time to do new cool things. So while I'm getting a master's degree, I should also go start a new career path. And I jumped in. We shut down Adobe Story. We started a beta program for a social publishing service, which would help with analytics and help with giving user feedback. We launched that at a trade show, our Mac show, as a giant public beta. I worked on all of the tools that helped connect the primary video tools, so the things that were like the connective tissue between Premiere Pro and After Effects, or After Effects and Audition, or Premiere and Audition, or just video streaming. So anytime you went to Adobe Stock and looked at video, we managed that piece. And I did that for a while, and that head of product came back to me and said, so you've been doing really well at this. What I want you to do is run all the products and all these services. And I, like a goofball, said, sure. And I did that for a while. And during that time, we continued to grow the products. We continued to satisfy customer needs. We continued to strive to serve new customer segments that we hadn't served before. Premiere got their first feature film edited on Premiere. We started being used by almost every large broadcaster, and it was a really good time. I got to meet all these cool YouTubers who I was watching and all these other amazing content creators. And during that time, I started watching Twitch. And Twitch was experiencing ridiculous growth in viewership and growth in streaming. And it was some of the ugliest content I'd ever seen. So I said to my boss, hey, we should do something. We should do something with this, because streaming is growing really fast. At this point, Facebook was also putting a ton of effort behind streaming. YouTube was doing live streaming. All of the little pop-up live streaming services like Periscope and others were coming up, and my boss declined. And I felt very frustrated. And I was like, oh, I don't know why we're not doing this. It's so important. And I continued working on the products I was working on. And one day, LinkedIn popped up a little, hey, here's a job you might be interested in. And I think in the first time in my professional history, it was a job I was interested in. It was a director of product for Bits and Cheering, which is one of the commerce products at Twitch. And I thought, I'll just go check it out. I don't even know that I'd want it, but it'd be cool to see what Twitch is like. And I didn't realize they had a Seattle office, and I'll just go check it out. And I went and interviewed, and very shortly after left Adobe and went to Twitch. So I've been at Twitch for a little over a year. In that time, I went from being head of Bits to head of Bits and Central Commerce to head of Commerce product. So the entire umbrella of products under that now are in a reporting chain that is more unified. That decision was made not because I'm amazing, but because there was a disconnect between the different products that we had and how we evaluated success for those products and prioritized how they were built. So I'm here tonight to talk to you about roadmaps, talk about how you get those great product ideas that come from your team and from your customers and from your stakeholders and from random people on the street, and put those into an order that makes sense, right? I recently took our organization with the other leaders in our group through a reorganization where we restructured the way that we imagine our product line. We went from being discrete buckets of product into an umbrella where we look at our customers as a shared customer, because our customers are a shared customer. They generally cross between the products that we produce and cross between the interactions that we produce, and they're all showing up to the same place. They're all showing up to look at the same content. They are not discrete product profiles. So instead of doing everything we can to make one successful and doing everything we can to make the other successful without looking between those products, which can actually cause competition and success for this may be failure for this. So we're looking at our product line a little more holistically. In doing this, we reorganized our group, and we reorganized into four new buckets and promoted some new product kind of product leads for those different areas. I was recently working with one of my product leaders, and we'd gone through all the hard part of setting the mission, vision, strategy, and we'd aligned what the groups were working on and what the KPIs for those different groups were, because we're stepping back from just looking at revenue, and we're looking at how do we move levers to make things push towards revenue, but without putting a revenue target on everything, because that's less fun to work towards. And it also, that competing thing happens a lot when you do that. And we gave some opportunities to some people who hadn't been leading a whole product line before. And I was talking to this product manager, and she was really stressed. And I was like, "What? Why are you so stressed?" Like, she was starting to get their roadmap ready for Q1, starting to look at what they could do, should do, want to do, all of the wide open possibilities. And she just started talking about how much there was to consume and how much was available to put into this roadmap, and how hard it was to figure out the right thing to do and how to measure and how, what is the, this seems important, but this seems important, and I don't know how to reconcile those two. And she was really, really worried about getting it right, which brought to mind Chidi Adegonya. Does anybody here watch The Good Place? Hands? Okay. Oh, boy. So The Good Place is one of my favorite shows ever. I'm not going to reveal what the big tell behind the show is, but this character is a philosophy professor who spends his whole life in paralysis over trying to get to the answer for things. He believes if you analyze any question enough, you will get the right answer, which is exactly where my product manager was. And as I talked her through it and understood more about what her concerns were, I came to the point that she needed to hear. There is no right answer. In product management, there is not one right answer. You can analyze, somebody else can analyze, and you can come up to two different paths. And that doesn't mean either of them are wrong. There are many right answers. What you need to do is have a consistent approach so you know that you're measuring equally. So if I'm looking at features and saying, this is good, and this is good, and this is good, and I don't have enough time to do all three of those, I'll just do this one. There should be a reason why I'm choosing this one over the other one. And if I find some more time and I go, oh, but this is also good, I'm going to put that one in, and I'm going to ignore these two, and I'm looking at them through different lenses, we're not necessarily getting to a place of good understanding of customer need, not getting to a good place for your product as a whole solution. And that can be overwhelming, it can be frustrating, and I'm telling you this, and you're like, yeah, we know that, and it's one of the harder parts of being a product manager. But for me, it's one of the most fun parts of being a product manager, because when you get that, remember when I talked about the open field and the opportunity to learn and change and change the future? It's awesome. So here's where product prioritization frameworks come in. This is where you start applying a system to how you evaluate the necessity and value of the different features, investments, products you could make, right? Yes, okay. So why would you use a product prioritization framework as opposed to just willy-nilly picking stuff or just everything that's written in blue ink gets in the product? One is because we are not product managers in a silo. Or maybe you are, but if you are, I don't know who you're building for or where you build that you just get to build your own thing. In general, we are working to satisfy a customer, to satisfy a company need as well. We have outcomes that we're looking for. By satisfying those customers, we are working with people who may not be as in-depth in all of the options and features and priorities that we could have. So you set a standard for communication on how do we discuss the things that are in or out. So how do we keep that conflict down when something isn't making it in? How do I explain that to somebody who's passionate about that one feature that just isn't going to make it this time? And it also, like I said, it provides a similar sizing of value. So it gives you the opportunity to say, this is something that needs to be in. This is also something that needs to be in. This thing is different in this way, and it doesn't need to be in. But it gives you that, it gives you a language and a methodology that helps you to move through the possible into the possible. Yep. And I think I just said moves through the possible into the possible, into the doable. How about that? Okay. Now, when you start off with project prioritization, you don't just jump in and say, I'm going to start just ranking stuff, right? Because we have to think about a number of influences for your business and for your customers always first. For me, the thing I always start with is what have I heard from my customers? What have I seen in the data of use where problems are arising? What have I seen in behaviors that are unexplained? What do I know about my customers' behaviors and needs that might influence my product prioritization framework even? Yeah? Product strategy. If I'm in a growth period and I need to look at new user acquisition, that might give me a different prioritization than if I'm in a maintenance mode where I just need to keep the thing from crashing or I just need to make sure it works on new OSs. Investment areas. If I know I'm expanding in a certain way to acquire a new customer set or to meet a company-wide goal, those things matter. Development cycles. How frequently am I shipping? How long do I have? Is it a big cycle where I can jam a lot of stuff in, or is it quick turnaround? With that goes resourcing. Do I have a huge team of talented people? Do I have one guy? Because all of that matters. It changes the way you prioritize. Stakeholder input. Are there things from teams that we work with or teams that or individuals in our organization who have a vested interest in the way our product works that I need to consider and make sure are part of my prioritization process? And in general, also the competitive landscape. If someone is outdoing you in one area, even if you choose not to go that direction, you should be aware of it and make that a conscious decision and prioritization choice, not, I didn't realize, because that's bad decision making. I'm going to present a few of the frameworks that my teams have used and do use, and I'll talk you through a little bit of the pros and cons of those. You can ask me questions about them, we can dive deeper, or we can just keep running forward. So one of my favorites when I was working with teams that had very active user bases who were also accessible directly, so we had a means to connect with them directly, was by a feature. And by a feature, instead of getting into this survey of things, it helps you evaluate how much money people are willing to spend on things. So what you do is, depending on the features and the complexity of those features, you select the set that you are considering for a release. You price them based on how complex they are or how big they are, and you pull together either a group of customers, which is the best way to do it, who represent your various user segments. Don't just get all the people who work in one area of your customer, but you do a diverse set of customers. You give them this shopping list, and you give them a budget. You have $100. Of your $100, what would you buy? Okay? And then they go through, and they price it out. Now, this is the experience, this experience was the one that our customers I was working with at the time said, I don't want any of these things. I'll give you $100 if you just fix your damn bugs. That's not on the list, but we made it on the list. So by asking them where they would put money behind things on a finite set of money, instead of having to explain to them, like, listen, we've got a finite engineering team and we're trying to ship on a certain time, you can kind of guardrail it. It's more fun, it's more interactive, and it's really easy to walk through, even with people who don't have a depth of technical background and don't necessarily understand the dependencies. It requires your team to do a bit of upfront sizing, which is always good. And it gets you to be crisp about how you're describing your features, which is always good because it keeps feature creep kind of minimized. The problem with this method is that if your customers do not speak up and say, hey, you've given us this thing and all we want are these bug fixes, which a lot of times they won't, it only offers them the things that you know that you're planning on working on. And you don't necessarily get the feedback from customers on, these are all cool, but there's this other thing that we've been asking for and it's not on your list and we'd really like that instead. This is good if you know your customer segment really well and understand what their working priorities are. This just helps to knock them into place, but there are some limitations with any framework. All right? Questions about buy a feature? Anybody want to buy a feature? No? Okay. Scoring. Scoring, I lumped a number of frameworks under scoring. What scoring seeks to do is take the balance of complexity and usefulness or value and assign it a number. So you get things that are all numbered in a similar way. Right now we're using RICE scoring where I'm at, which is reach, how many customers are going to use this thing, impact, how influential in their experience is this thing going to be, how, you know, how much pain is it solving or creating or fun it's solving and creating. Confidence. How sure are we that this will be used by that number of people and be this successful? It's also how sure are we that we can deliver it? And then you multiply those scores together and divide it by effort. So how hard is it? And you get a very nice score. And if you do this for all of your products, you get, or for all of your features, you get a nice score to use. Again, good things about this. In order to get a good RICE score or a lean score or a weighted scorecard or a value versus effort, any of these, you have to really be thoughtful about how you're sizing the effort of a product. Anything where you're looking at, is the value worth the time spent on it? You have to know how much time you're going to spend on it. You also have a pretty good understanding of what you perceive the value to be, right? So anything that forces you to go through that process up front, helpful, good, positive. The drawback of any scoring method is while you are getting a number, those numbers are still estimates, and some people over-rotate on the fact that I had a number that said that this was super high value and super, you know, we had super high confidence. So you have to properly frame it with your team that just because it has a high number doesn't mean that it's guaranteed success. There's still a human thought process going into this process. There's still an evaluation. Things might become discovered as we start actually engineering it that are more complex. They also don't tend to look at dependencies because you're kind of looking at the things that you know how to build, and it's hard to get that firm value on things that are external. Right? Okay. This is one that is very much UI aligned when the question about how do you make sure those UI friction points are addressed. Story mapping. Have people done story mapping? So story mapping breaks your work that could be done and efforts that could be done down along the customer experience. So when they first come to your product, what does that first look like? What does the search function look like? What does the account creation look like? What does the first access of premium content look like? And you prioritize under each of those areas from most important to least important. So instead of looking at the entire product and trying to say, oh, well, something in account creation, that's super huge. And I've got this thing over in, you know, search that's also super huge. And then I've got a bunch of tiny things, but these tiny things actually are way more important. Instead of trying to prioritize disparate things, you break down the user flow. And then you draw a line across all those areas based on the amount of effort you have and make sure that that, I hate the term minimum viable product because it should always be lovable. So the minimum lovable product is of the right quality, and then you can move things up or down based on that if things are disparate across the different parts of the experience. This is really good, in my opinion, for new products when you're just starting a new workflow and experience. When you're looking, focused specifically on onboarding or friction removal, this is a really good way to do that because it is focused on the user's experience. What it doesn't always take into consideration are external strategy influences or marketplace influences. So things that another product may be doing that you're not doing don't necessarily always bubble up in the same way in this mapping as they do in other prioritization frameworks. So, like I said, there's a million ways to get answers. Just being aware of what ones are good at and what ones are less good at, and when to apply one versus the other is really helpful because, like I said, my team's using Rice right now, but we've also used, there's another one where you look at delighters and called the Kano method, where you give a survey to your customers and they rate how important things are. And then you kind of balance how many things are fundamental, how many things are exciting and fancy and new, and how many things are kind of in that mid-range. Yep, so a billion ways to get to a right answer, and I'm just walking through a handful of them. This one is one that I really, 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 really love. And this is one, if you have a team that likes to debate, this is for you. This is the Moscow method. Now, the Moscow method has nothing to do with Russia or information thievery or influencing elections. Moscow is an acronym that is made from must have, should have, could have, won't have. So the MSCW kind of pull from there. So instead of looking at an entire backlog and prioritizing across that entire backlog in relative rank order for now and forever, Moscow method looks release by release. So you're looking at a snapshot in time, which I think is pretty cool because I don't know about you guys, but the industries I've worked in have shifted dramatically even in the time span of a release. Influences have come into play that we need to address that maybe weren't there 6 months ago, or maybe changed dramatically in priority from 6 months ago. The Moscow method has you bucket your effort and your features and your investment areas into the must-haves, things that absolutely have to be in your product. Can't live without them. Customers would scream. Should-haves. These are the things that are not quite must-haves, not quite the things that would make you look ridiculous if you delivered a product without them, but the things that a good product would have. It's beyond that. We've got table stakes, and here's fine china, right? Could-haves are the things, if we had flexibility and time to do these, I would include these. These are the things that could be differentiators. They could be good for our users, but they're not in that requirement range. So you see there's like shades going on, and then the won't-haves. The won't-haves, to me, are the most important. The things that I am not going to do in this release, and you can't make me. And having a criteria set for why those aren't important now is really useful for those conversations when your stakeholders come back and go, but that thing, customers have asked us for that thing. And you're like, yes, we're not doing that. In this release, we are not focusing on personalizing dog food flavors. So the personalization feature doesn't need to be there, right? It also focuses very much on the order of things that need to be done. Now, the thing I like about the Moscow method is that these buckets, they are flexible over time. So I can start the next release, move should-haves into must-haves, some of them down to could-haves. So you can continue to rebucket things. And the only ones that you really need to focus on getting into a good rank order are the must-haves and the should-haves, really. The could-haves, you kind of bubble those up. But the won't-haves, if I'm not doing on this release, I don't have to argue relative priority between two things I'm not doing. It doesn't mean I'll never do them. They may come in the next release, but they are set aside for the time being. So it takes a huge number of things up off the table. This one is one that I kind of made up because it's one that I've used with teams when we are driven by KPIs other than hard metrics, when we are looking at levers, moving a specific lever for a part of our business, and things that are within our control that we consider input metrics. What can we directly influence that could influence the longer term benefit for the kind of traditional growth metrics, right? The way I have encouraged teams to think about this is use prioritization to determine which questions you have that most need answering and which questions, when answered, will give you the biggest push to that metric. Does that make sense? Kind of. I know my customers all have elephants. I'm going to use this one, and I have no idea where it even came from, but elephant pants are the thing tonight. So we know that 90% of our customers have elephants. We also know that 20% of them have pants. The elephants, not the customers. God, that would be a whole different thing. Okay. We know that our customers' happiness depends on their elephants having pants because we've read this on social, because they've reported this to customer support, because people with elephants with pants have a longer lifespan according to recent studies. I'm making stuff up, clearly. What do we hope to learn? We hope to learn if providing an understood need that betters their lives makes them more likely to continue to be a customer, retention, or spend more on our product because of the pants, our poo-poo, or bring new customers who have not yet been in our cohort of pantless or panted elephants to our marketplace because we are now the premier purveyor of elephant pants conversion. So what we're trying to do is move our business metrics, but we're moving it with things that we can measure a little closer to the bone. Yeah? So for me, I like this one when I've got a team that's feeling antsy. This is one when my product manager was feeling like she didn't know what the right answer was. I'm like, just guess. What do you think the right answer is? What makes you think that? Cool. You think the right answer is this because you know these things about our customers. So you're already doing better than most people could do. What do you think that looks like? If you're right, what does that end up looking like? And it puts it into a place where it feels like there's less wrong and right. It feels a little more like gambling, a little bit like betting. For some people, that's a real like nice soft space to work in. You still obviously have to look at what your priorities are for your organization, what your priorities are for your business strategy, how these things roll up to move your key metrics. But it does make it feel a little bit more iterative when you're saying, we're going to test this. We think this is the outcome, and here's why we think that's the outcome. It feels a little more like a conversation than a, are you right or wrong? Which can be off-putting for, especially, this is one when I'm bringing product managers up from being, I see product managers who I do things like, hey, here's a thing I need you to go figure out how to build. Go do that. And they aren't necessarily laddering up to how that looks for the business. This one works really well for that first step into laddering up to the business. What does this do on a broader scale? This isn't just one thing that I need you to write a spec and understand the customer workflow for it. This goes into to that next tier of thought. How do you think bigger than the one thing? Yeah? Yes.
So if I come in saying customers are going to spend 20%, or your assumption is 20% more on your site or whatever, and you get 5% in reality, how do you dictate that stakeholder saying, like, these were assumptions, like, how do you, I guess, still keep credibility? Or how do you not,
No, it is credibility, right? Because you were wrong.
It is an assumption. So it come back to you and be like, here are two numbers, because there are going to be facts in front of
them. So, product managers are wrong all the time. We ship garbage more than we should. Like, so with this one, the thing that I think has worked for stakeholders with me is if I bring them along the story, we know this, we believe this, and this should be the outcome based on what we understand. And you don't get that outcome, and then you come back to your review, and you say, you know what? People cared a lot less about elephant pants than we thought. We've also seen, by doing a little post-release analysis, that actually there was a lot of false reporting of elephant elephant owners, that people just had really big dogs. We didn't have a good intake mechanic on our website to report what kind of pet you had, and everything got reported as an elephant. It was confusing and wrong, and we fixed that problem. And what we're going to do now is look at really big dog pants with the understanding that we've solved this other data point problem. So if you're wrong, I mean, it may not do 20%. Maybe it does 5, right? 5 is still better than 0. And actually, 5% overall revenue growth, I'd happily take that. Right. Yeah. No, I'm just teasing. But no, the thing that you do is you go back with all of this. The and then the what? I've prioritized. I've got my priorities list. What do? You execute. You go and deliver things. You learn. You evaluate where you were right and wrong. And you do it again. Right? So everything comes down to, we prioritize this based on the assumption that it would do well for us. Did it do well for us? And then why not? And so then you go through your data, you go through user stories, you do user interviews, you evaluate what actually happened, because that kind of stuff is amazing. Like, hey, we put this thing in and nobody used it, but they all went to this other thing that had previously not been touched a lot. Why? So you learn. And then you repeat the process. Now, knowing these new things that we know, how do we make better choices in the next time? And it's always just honing your story. It's always honing your product. It's always iterating, right? Yes?
So is it better to be wrong, or is it better to not make a mistake?
I think that if you never made a mistake, and I tell my team this a lot, so, yeah. If you are never making a mistake, you're not doing very interesting things. You're staying in a really safe zone. You're in that product that all the data tells you exactly what you need to build time and time again, and you never have to guess. That sounds tedious. It also means if you never make a mistake, you're never making a big bet, right? Think about things that have been very transformational. If I told you that I was going to create a device that you use every single day that's going to cost 3 times as much as the device you currently have, but has half the features, it just looks better. Do you think as a product manager that's a great device to build? No? Because the iPhone did pretty well, right? And it didn't have the ability to copy paste in text. It didn't have the ability to text images. There were a lot of features missing from the first iPhone. But the experience on that and the bet that was placed on that was correct because of the understanding of the type of user who would use an iPhone. Right? So I would rather have a good mix of right and wrong. I would rather not be wrong all the time, because then you would be unemployed. But I think you have a certain amount of things that you know. And you know them through data, you know them through customer interviews, you have the highest level of confidence. And then you have to have some things that are a little less known, some things that are brand new, some things that are controversial, some things that are built on assumptions from things you've learned, but it's a big step, not a tiny step. Because those things are what keeps products vibrant. Yeah? And I saw your hand go up. Go.
Yeah, dude, I love that you use the term bet, because that is a really, really important word. So we always talk about, I don't want to be wrong, right? And there's a great book out there called Thinking in Bets. I don't know if anyone's read it. It's by Andy Duke. It's a wonderful book. But from a product perspective, what I love about it is that you don't want to go into most situations trying to be right.
Yeah.
You're probably never going to be right. So the title of the book is Thinking in Bets When You Don't Have All the Facts. And you most certainly won't always have facts. So if you go into those discussions and talk about the probability of what could happen, it's less about being right or wrong and more about, well, what chance do we have to succeed here? And it's less about the right wrong thing. And after reading this book, I was like, wow, that really changes the dynamic.
Totally.
Right? Now you don't have to go back to sales or the stakeholder or the customer and say, well, we were wrong. It's like, well, we had a pretty good idea that the probability of this working is like 10%. It was a big bet. It was going to be really hard. And then it's like, oh, well, no wonder it didn't work. It was a big bet. As opposed to, a much higher probability.
Absolutely. I also, in the hypothesis-driven framework that I was talking about, a lot of the things that I encourage people to do there is, what are we testing and how small can it be? How will I get more information on, especially on big bets? We're going to go and make this enormous thing that we think people will love, but we have no idea other than gut instinct. And we saw something similar, in the store that sells horse pants. We don't know. But how small can I make that bet? Can I start by doing something that's a sprint? Is there a way I can put it together that is satisfying, that is two sprints? Is there something that I can get signal back so I can do it? And if people are like, oh God, no, we're not touching that at all, we can walk away from it. And this is one of the things that we've done that I worked on last year was a huge bet, and we segmented down into minimum. This will give us signal based on these criteria. That didn't work. We're not going to do more of it. This will give us signal based on these criteria. Yeah, looks like it's good. Let's go to the next stage. These are the next things that would need to be true for that giant thing to work. Yeah, we can't make those happen. Okay, so we know that the first tier is good. We know that the second tier is not going to resonate with our users. So instead of... I talk a lot about big bets. I talk a lot about think about what big could be or what different could be or, how far you can get from the known. But it doesn't mean do stupid things. And it certainly doesn't mean throw all of your resources on things that you have not enough signal to have a gut feel that it's the right thing. And be realistic about how certain you are. If you convince your stakeholders, oh no, this is a slam dunk, absolutely a slam dunk, it's going to be amazing, and it isn't, you lose credibility. If you're able to say, we think this has the potential to be big, and it sounds like I'm using soft words, but product management is all about building credibility and building reliability and helping people down that path with you. If I come in and say, we believe this has the potential to be big because of these three things that we know, this is the expected outcome if we deliver this thing. It puts it into a understandable kind of set of expectations that people can take apart instead of, well, you told me it was going to be huge. Now I have a whole warehouse full of elephant pants. Yeah? Yes?
Oh, so quick question. So at some point, if you keep making mistakes, like, you're going to have a talk with them, right?
Oh, God, yes.
Speaking of, like, bets, would you rather have someone who makes $10 bets, but then, mostly makes, like, $300 in wins, or someone who makes $100 bets, keeps losing, but then makes, like, a, $10,000 pot? Like, who are you looking at?
Oof. Oh, that's
what's your betting strategy?
Yeah, my betting strategy.
Do you have a framework?
So for how I put people out on the betting floor, let's see if I can walk through this one in a way that makes sense. That's a really good question. I look for people who have the ability to understand when they're making a big bet versus a little bet. And I look for people who can balance their portfolio in the same way that you would manage your 401k, with some things that might have a huge potential and some things that are stable, right? If someone fails on a lot of small bets, but the one that they land is enormous, I would have, let's see, how it is enormous and how enormous was measured is important. Is it enormous because now all of a sudden my customers will never leave because they are so addicted to that new thing that was put in? Then I probably am pretty forgiving. Is it revenue? Maybe. But I would wonder about what happened with all those small bets if we did things that eroded customer trust or eroded usability or fragmented product strategy or took our product down a path that we're not going down anymore, which adds confusion. So I don't think it's as easy as a big success or a small success or a small failure, because if you do enough things, exactly, you go back and you learn from what worked, didn't work, make different choices, and repeat. But for somebody who continually was like, hey, here's the thing, let's just go do it, let's do it, I would probably have a talk with that person about, like, you're going to go bankrupt one day. I'm really worried about your retirement planning. Yeah?
This episode was brought to you by Miro, the online collaborative whiteboard where distributed product teams get work done. Go from idea to execution using pre-built Kanban boards, sticky notes, and retrospectives, all on an infinite canvas. Learn more and try Miro for free. Visit Miro.com to get started. That's Miro.com.
Thank you for listening to the Product Podcast. If you like this episode, don't forget to leave a review on iTunes. For more product insights, head over to productschool.com.